The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores. I am Peddlin' Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk. It's April 17th, 2023, to be rebroadcast on April 19th at our regular times on WHUS 91.7 FM and WHUS.org. Welcome to Bicycle Talk without my friendly co-host, lovely Dr. Fran Storch, because she's working, being a doctor, doing her thing. So if you're watching on Facebook Live, you can feel free to comment, but I may not be able to comment back because I'm kind of in the middle of trying to do a show, and that's kind of the way it works. If you're just listening to this on audio, you can always leave comments on my Facebook page, or you can also leave comments by sending me an email at bicycletalk, the numeral one, at gmail.com. Bicycle Talk is a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, upcoming news and cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you have a comment, you'd like to contribute information to the show, and you're listening on Facebook Live, you can comment right down here below. Just drop me an email, bicycletalk, the numeral one, at gmail.com. That works really good, too. You can listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, or now on fmradiofree.com. Ron's rant of the week. Got you a big one right here. I'm having a huge audio problem this morning. That's a big rant. I think it's recording and working out, but I may have to get clever and creative here, but it appears that things are working. Hate it when things don't go quite right. Anyway, have I mentioned to you before how much I hate the truck revolution in this country? Well, if you've never heard it before, this must be your first time listening to Bicycle Talk, because I talk about this all the time. So I have here a study that SUV drivers are causing 55% more 55% worse injuries to bicyclists that they hit. Isn't that nice to know? I'm going to have more on this on the show. We'll get into it a little bit deeper. We'll discover what was discovered. And it's kind of a DUH moment, or what we like to call around here a DUH moment. Like, duh. How would you not know this? Anyway, we'll move on to that later on in the show. On a positive side, we had another great weekend club ride. The Thread City Cyclers had three different rides that went off, and they all ended up rendezvousing upon the same place. And so we went to a really cool little bakery, Laziza's Bakery, a Lebanese bakery down in Yantic, Connecticut. If you've never been there before, you should definitely come check it out. It's totally cool. If you don't like the baklava, you're going to love the guy that makes it. He's just a hoot. He's just a really good time. So anyway, we all converged upon this one place, all leaving from different destinations or at different distances, and we ended up showing up pretty much at the same time. It's kind of cool. So we had quite a few people hanging out there, and we sort of, I guess we kind of cash bombed him with lots of little hungry appetites from riding our bikes there. So it was very cool. We had a great time. That was definitely a good thing. On another, let's see, I've got a bunch of positive sides here. I rode my bicycle to the community center twice this week, the past week, to teach my class. The weather has been so unbelievable. It's warm enough in the mornings to actually get out, and at a reasonable temperature, you can just ride your bike. So, of course, it's dark out, but I have lights, and I can, you know, handle that sort of thing. That was really cool. And then one of my spin students in the class, Karen, decided that she thought it was such a good idea that she wanted to join me on Friday. So she rode over to my house, and then we rode from here and took off on the road at 4:45 in the morning, and off we went to the community center. It is nice to have company at 4:45 in the morning, because otherwise it's pretty lonely out there. It's quiet, it's dark, there aren't a lot of cars. That's a good thing, right? But anyway, so that's a big tip of the cycling cap to Karen for joining me and having a great ride. And she was talking about it all day today, too, so that was kind of cool. And yesterday I spent the afternoon up at the UConn campus because they had something called Community Bike Ride. And it was basically for the students to come by and check out some guest speakers. I was one of them. And we talked about the different things that we're doing here in the town of Mansfield to create some buzz about Bike Mansfield. And there's a lot more to talk about there, too. And I will have something posted on the Facebook page on this really soon, too, because we are starting a crowdfunding program or something. I can't remember exactly what they call that. But anyway, we're going to try to raise some money for the new elementary school bicycle program for the fourth grade. And what we're trying to do is we're actually trying to raise money for funding the program, for buying bicycles, paying instructors, etc., and also housing the bicycles there too, because as much as they just built a brand new building, they don't have quite enough room to put all the bikes in that we need to be able to teach the students how to ride bikes and rules of the road and safety issues and maintenance issues and all. It's just a wonderful, wonderful program. And so I'll have more information and more news on that on a future episode, but pretty cool stuff. Anyway, we talked about a number of different things. We also talked about, my friend Corey talked about the development on campus of the of making campus a safer and easier place to ride a bike through. So we're doing some really good things there. Some pedestrian upgrades. There's going to be some bicycle upgrades on campus, which is really good, really good. And it is kind of sort of about time that something like that happened on UConn campus. So we're looking forward to seeing what happens over the next couple of years as far as that goes, because it will be a really positive thing. And, you know, the idea is if we can make the campus safer for cycling around campus and start shutting down some of the motorized vehicle traffic that's on the center part of campus, it'll just be a lot nicer place in general. So it'd be kind of cool. So Corey talked about that. My friend Lon talked about Bike Mansfield and the elementary school program. And we had a woman, and I'm terribly sorry, I've completely forgotten her name. She's going to drop me a text or an email, so we'll get caught up on that. And she was from the bicycle co-op in New Haven down by Yale University. And she had some really great things to say about what they're doing and how the Bradley Street Co-op is operating down there. So that was cool. That was totally cool. And then I just, you know, did my standard verbal diarrhea thing and talked all about bikes and why everybody should ride bikes and why, you know, driving around in motorized vehicles is not a great idea and riding bicycles is a great idea because that's what I believe in. And so I just, you know, walked the walk and talked the talk and did my thing and tried to get everybody all enthused about cycling. So they had a loop that you could do, and every time you rode the loop, you would get a prize for riding the loop, and they were giving away lights and tubes and different things for your bicycle, which was kind of lube, all different things for your bike. So the more laps you did, the more stuff you could go home with. It was kind of a cool thing. It was a closed off course, so there weren't any cars on it, and it was just really a fun day and a fun event. So anyway, that was good. That was fun. That's definitely on the positive side. All right, let's move on to the mechanical minute and cycling tips. So a listener asked me, what gearing are the pros using on their bikes? Well, you know, the pros are the pros. So, they're strong, they're professional racers, they have, they're being paid to ride their bikes. So they're obviously in a league that is way above any of us out there that are probably listening to this podcast right now. Pros are often using, just so you know, a 55 by 11 tooth high gear for time trials. Now, of course, they have other gears besides that, too. But anyway, they are using those for time trials. On flat or rolling stages, they might have a 5339 chainring in the front and maybe an 1121 or an 1123 in the back. It's pretty big gear, sometimes a 25. But now, these days, they're kind of joining the big gear revolution. kind of like recreational riders are riding on right now. So for the very steep, long hills, you're going to see, especially like on some of the classics, you're going to see them now riding on gears on the back that are anywhere from a 28 to a 32 cog. And I made this change on my bike recently, and I got to tell you, I should have done it a long time ago. It's really helpful because you can keep your cadence up really high when you're climbing a hill if you're in a little bit lower gear. And climbing, gearing, spinning like a pro. Many riders can't spin at 90 RPMs on climbs if they're, you know, if you have a lower gear, it does help you get there. And then the other thing about it, too, it's simply a matter of power. The pros can spin fast because they have the power to do so. High climbing cadence isn't a result of training to climb that way. Instead, it's a result of from a rider having so much power that they can spin fast and thus spare leg muscles for crunch time. Remember, it's really deceptive to compare yourself to a pro because you're not. Okay, unless you are, and I doubt very much I have pros listening to this show. It's kind of not really that kind of show. So, they're just in a different league. And when you compare yourself to a pro and you say, well, you know, I can do this I know I could ride with a pro someday. No, you can't. You can't do it. Okay? Can't do it. Doesn't happen. It's really, really difficult. They will leave you like your yesterday's news. It's just amazing how much wattage they can put out. So when you can generate, okay, here we go. This puts it into reality. When you can generate over 400 watts of power for an hour or more, like many of them can, you can maintain a high cadence at a lot bigger gear than the average recreational bike racer who puts out a little over 200 watts. Case in point, and I use this example a lot, Matthew Vanderpoel last year in the Tour de Flanders, which he won, I was watching him. I had a Strava feed on him, and I was watching him, and he was averaging 390 watts for the 120, 130 miles that race is. When he got to the cobbled section with the 20%+ grade on it, where he literally left everyone behind, and they were all just like watching him just leave. And I could see people just shaking their heads in the pack, and they're watching this guy go. His wattage output went up somewhere around 1,600 watts. If you don't understand any of this, I get it. You know, you will in time when you become geeky enough like I am, and then, you know, you start looking at watts as, you know, things to understand and what you can put out, what you can't put out. We're just not all designed to put out that super high wattage. Some are better than others at it. And there's so many factors involved with it. There's strength to weight ratio. There's size of the rider. Bigger riders tend to put out bigger wattage. Also, bigger riders have a little bit harder time going up bigger hills. So, you know, there's just way, way, way too many factors to compare yourself to a pro. Don't even think about it. But if you have the inkling to do it and you're thinking that, you know what, this is where I want to go. You know, I'm listening to the bicycle talk. I'm listening to Pedal and Ron. He's obviously very enthusiastic about bicycle racing. I want to learn more. I want to go forward. You got to find yourself a local club that is a racing-oriented club. You need to join USA Cycling, which is a governing body for bicycle racing here in the United States. And then from there, you go forward. I'm a really, really strong believer in getting anyone who comes to me and asks me about it. I almost always put them on a cyclocross bike for the first season and get them to race cyclocross so they can learn two things. First, how to really put out and hurt for an hour because that's what you're going to do. And then second, how to handle your bike. I see so many people that get involved in bike racing and they have had no experience with it. They haven't joined a local club, which happens to be, you know, developing and promoting bike racing in general. And so they don't know how to ride in a group. They're just dangerous. They may be strong, they may be powerful. You know, one of their friends may have said, boy, you should race bikes, you're really fast. It's not all there is to it. There's a lot more components to it. So that's why I like to start everybody out, you know, on the cross bike, because the cross bike is just a great, it's a great reducer of your ego when you think you know everything. It will open your eyes and it will let you know that, guess what? I'm not so good at doing this as I thought I was. And it doesn't matter how fast you are. It matters how good you are. And as you get better with that and your technique and being able to sit in a pack of riders and bump elbows and not freak out over it, it comes pretty naturally after that. Still got to train. You still have to work hard. There's no question about that. But, you know, you're not a pro. But you can get there. There are development programs that will get you there. We have a great junior developer program right here in the state of Connecticut. It's Connecticut Cycling Advancement Program, and they are great at bringing kids into this whole interesting sport, which in the United States is quite new to a lot of these kids. You know, most of these kids grow up with, you know, soccer and baseball and football and maybe some running. There's definitely some good running development programs out there. There's lacrosse. There's hockey. There's a lot of sports that kids are brought into, team sports that the kids are brought into. But there's not usually as much influence with cycling. So I'm always excited when I see a young kid who wants to learn about how to ride a bike and how to race a bike. And they used to drop into my store all the time when I had my bike store, because they knew that I had a background in it. And I brought people from anywhere from local racing all the way to Europe. And it was kind of fun. You know, it was kind of fun to watch and see how it all worked. But I will say that I've had a number of people who've come up to me after the fact and have said, you know, that thing that you wanted me to do when I first wanted to race my bike and you made me do a season of cyclocross and I hated you for it. And I kind of laugh and they go, that was like the best advice I ever got, because it has saved my butt so many times in tricky situations. You really got to learn how to ride the bike before you can ride the bike. That's all I need to say. I'm not going to go any further into it. I rant about it all the time, but we're going to move on to what is going on in the world of cycling as I see it and as it is fed to me. So here we go. I just, you know, some things just really, really get under your skin. And one of the big things that gets under my skin is the size of automobiles and trucks that are on our highways right now. Our roads aren't really made for them. There's the drivers that are driving them really don't know how to drive them. And it's just a bad idea from day one. But I understand the fact that if you're a contractor and you need a big truck to be able to do your work, I get it. That's fine. I accept it. It's a good thing. But for the average Joe that just wants to drive his truck back and forth to work and doesn't do anything with it, I don't get it at all. It just doesn't work for me. Do something else. Ride your bike. That'll boost your ego. You know, that'll make you feel stronger and better and more manly, if it must be, or womanly, if it must be. You'll feel very powerful if you get on your bicycle. But anyway, study. SUV drivers cause 55% worse injuries to bicyclists that they hit. This is from our good friends at Streets Blog, one of my favorite sites to go to for bicycle advocacy and other things. And it popped up and I'm looking at it and I'm going, well, here we go again. I'm going to talk about it again. And I know I talk about this a lot, but I'm just trying to figure out the whole mentality behind why you need a bigger vehicle. If there's only one of you in it, makes no sense. But That's just me, my opinion. I have lots of opinions. My opinions, I feel, tend to be more on the practical side as far as transportation goes. My dad was an automobile mechanic. I grew up around cars, and I grew up around cars that were as stupid as cars can be. I grew up around the muscle cars of the 70s and the 60s, and I'm going to tell you, they were stupid. They were polluting. They were dangerous. They were just really not a great idea. And they were enormous. So they took up a lot of the highway. The good news is that our technology has now changed to the point where you can actually control that size vehicle, or if you're paying attention. Whereas back in those days, it was just horsepower, four wheels, man. And, you know, where you landed, nobody knew. It was just, they were scary, scary machines. And they also consumed great quantities of fuel, and they spewed out all sorts of environmental, yeah, they were bad. Anyway, so I grew up around that, and I understand that. When I got the chance to buy my first car, personal car, it was tiny. It was a little car. Got great gas mileage. It was fun to drive. It was easy to drive. And I've kind of been a small car guy ever since. I just really kind of like it better. I can still find a car small enough to put my bikes in the inside. That's a prerequisite, by the way, is that if you can't put your bikes in the back, then it's not the right car for you. So I'm not a big believer in sedans. Don't like those a whole lot. But I do like hatchback cars that have the ability to put things in them that are practical. Funny thing, if you go to Europe, that's what everybody drives, if they do drive over there. If they don't ride their bicycles for transportation and they have to use a vehicle for anything, it's usually a smaller, like a wagon, or, yeah, wagons that have become like the can't find them anywhere here in the United States are super popular over in Europe, super popular. And those are the vehicles you usually see those in. If you watch any pro cycling, you'll on TV, any of the European cycling, they're usually the team vehicles. You know, they use small Volkswagens, small Mercedes, Volvos, Skoda, which is a product of Volkswagen, and that's what they use because you can put a lot in them, and they're not that big. And the roads over in Europe are not that big either, because they built them a long time ago, and they're not like super highway as we are here. So, good morning, Kevin. A Datsun 1200, and I carried drums and my girlfriend in it. Wow. Now, there you go. Yeah, that Datsun 1200 was not a big vehicle at all. I was driving around at that time that you probably had that, Chris. I was driving in I had a Honda Civic CVCC. I bought it brand new, 1976. And it was not a big car, but took a couple of us down to Florida and back with bikes on the back. And, you know, we hung out in Florida for 3 weeks and trained and got ready for bike racing season. It worked. Anyway, I've had little cars over the years. But the idea is to find something that's practical. But we're not talking about cars today. We're talking about bikes. And here's where we get into this whole discussion about, just like pedestrian bicycles, bicyclists who are struck by SUV drivers endure significantly more severe injuries, particularly to the head, than those struck by the drivers of smaller cars, according to a new study that adds to a mountain of evidence that regulators should do more to rein in deadly vehicles that are increasingly dominating the U.S. roads. Let's get the CDC involved. You know, why don't we get them involved in, you know, because they look at disease and injury and accidents and things. Get them involved in this too. This is just a criminal offense that's going on here in this country right now. I do not like it, but all I can do is ride my bike and try my best to inform as many people as I can that, you know, have you really taken a second look at what you really need to transport yourself other than your bicycle? You know, if you got to get a motorized vehicle, Don't pick the biggest one in the lot. That's what the automakers want you to do. As a matter of fact, it's hard to find them anymore. Why? Because they can load the daylights out of those things, and they make huge profits when they sell them to you. And it just comes to a point where they're gonna price themselves out of the business if they keep going the direction they're going. If they go in the direction that Elon Musk thinks they're going to go, they're not only going to price themselves out, they're also going to get taken over by, this is his words exactly, e-bicycles by 2030 are going to outsell automobiles in the United States of America. How about that? That's, he's a visionary. I don't always agree with everything he does. I am not, a huge fan, but I do watch what he does and says, as I did Steve Jobs, who was also an innovator in his industry. He's not wrong. I think the millennials, the millennial age, and the Gen Zers are starting to have an impact on the automobile industry. I know they are, because their numbers, the automobile industry's numbers are down. So what does the automobile industry do when their numbers go down? They look at their most profitable vehicles and they boost and promote those so that they can keep their profit margin up. They don't make cars or trucks for the more financially challenged market. They just don't do it. And then they lose business up to 20%. That's a big number. That's a really, really big number. So researchers at the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, here's where it gets interesting, because when the insurance industry gets involved in it, then everybody has to listen. Okay, so they scrutinized a sample of bike car collisions in Michigan that contained significantly more detail than the average U.S. crash report, in hopes of better understanding what exactly happens to the average biker's body, when she's struck by a mega car. Oh, mega car. I like that. That's a good word. The answers weren't pretty. According to the abbreviated injury scale, a medical coding system that grades the severity of harm caused to the body after a trauma, cyclists hit by SUVs contained injuries that were 55% worse than those struck by smaller vehicles. The unlucky cyclist also endured 63% worse head traumas, which the researchers attributed to the fact that SUV crashes were more than twice as likely to cause ground impact injuries, or in plain language, to knock cyclists off their bikes completely onto the pavement, causing a second impact that can be more damaging than the initial contact with the car itself. Interesting, huh? I think it is. So anyway, what does this mean? Moreover, SUVs were the only vehicles in the sample that actually ran cyclists over, while sedans almost universally pushed the cyclists up onto the vehicle's hood or roof. That critical difference, the researchers speculate, has to do with the size and shape of the SUV's front end, which is more likely to strike a vulnerable road user near their center of gravity. It's kind of like, it's alarming. It really is. It's really a very, very unfortunate thing that we should have to be reading about this and hopefully understanding it. Gosh, I hope we can understand this. It's really, really scary to me. But this is our world. This is where we live. So the gory details may help explain why SUVs are so vastly overrepresented in the nation's road violence stats, even after accounting for the fact that the vehicle class comprised 57% of new car sales last year, making up a significantly higher percentage of registered vehicles in many states. According to one recent study, SUVs were the striking vehicle in 15% of U.S. crashes with pedestrians and cyclists since 2009, but were involved in 25% of the fatalities. Despite the horrifying statistics, though experts have been hesitant to definitively say why exactly SUVs are so much more lethal to vulnerable road users, even as evidence mounts that they are a leading factor in America's escalating death crisis among pedestrians and cyclists alike. I'll tell you why. Stand next to a Ford F-150 pickup truck, a brand new one. One of them just came off the line. Stand next to it. Where does your shoulder meet the hood of that vehicle? Simple request, simple question. There's the problem. There's the problem right there. They're too big. They're way too big. They are not going to be able to be, you know, we talk about making designated bike lanes for cyclists because it'll be safer for them. Why don't we have designated truck lanes for anyone who drives a behemoth? And you have to ride in that lane, and you can't ride anywhere else. You can't be anywhere else on the road. You have to stay in that designated lane. How about that for an idea? Okay? That way, they can't touch you. That way, they can't get near you. They can't get near you if you're in a small sedan, because they're stuck out there in the Jagundo lane, you know, the humongous lane, whatever you want to call it. We have the HOV lanes. Maybe we just need to have the humongous lane. It just drives me nuts, because this is a common sense answer and no one is really addressing it. Although, apparently, according to this article that I'm reading right now, the Insurance Institute is starting to address this. Why are they doing that? Because they're spending more time in court than they are at the bank. Well, that'll do it right there, won't it? So all of a sudden, the insurance industry is finding that they're putting huge payouts out because people are getting killed by these massive pieces of machinery that are going down the road. I gotta catch my breath. In recent years, researchers have found that wide A-pillars, if you don't know what an A-pillar is the section of metal that runs between your passenger and driver's side windows and your front windshield on your car or truck. And they need these big, huge aid pillars to hold all of that glass from all of that huge vehicle. And so they create blind spots when drivers turn. Huge front blind spots that make people and objects directly ahead of the vehicles virtually impossible for the drivers to see. And even high headlights that blind other motorists on the road may all be making SUV crashes more frequent or more lethal to vulnerable road users when they do. But those findings haven't always translated into hard recommendations to regulators to disallow specific vehicle features, recommendations to Congress to write policies to discourage SUV sales. Interestingly, the researchers found that heavy SUV weights are likely not a major factor at how deadly the crashes end up being, because cars in general are so much heavier than human bodies in the first place, though they are an important factor in vehicle-to-vehicle crash severity. Every study gets us a step closer towards getting the answer, and it does seem likely at this point that it's the higher front end that's playing the outsized role. And that's from Sam Monfort, an IIHS statistician and lead author of the study. Yeah, you know, it's the size. Size matters. Got that? Remember, we've all played around with that silly little thing about size mattering. Well, size totally matters here. It makes a huge difference. People get hurt when these vehicles are that big. It's not right. And this is a problem, and it's not needed. So if you take a look at marketing for automobile companies, why do they keep making the trucks bigger? Why? It's to satisfy a marketing survey of bigger is better. Okay? The marketing survey says, I don't feel very powerful anymore because I am tormented at work. I am tormented in my family life. Who the heck knows what it is? But people are weak and insecure right now, and the best way for them to create a strength for their weakness and insecurity is to give them something powerful. How about a bicycle? I feel really powerful when I'm on my bicycle. I really do. It works great for me, and it's so much better than a giant truck. Anyway, I know I'm preaching to the choir here. I know you guys out there that are listening are probably going, oh my God, you know, everything he says, it's the same thing over and over. It's true, but the point is we've got to get people to listen. So here's my plea to you. If you are listening to this and you're living in a neighborhood or you're living amongst lots of family members or whatever, and someone is looking at the possibility of buying a new vehicle, have a logical conversation with them. Or if you are looking at buying a new vehicle, have a logical conversation with yourself and think about the implications of this massive piece of metal going down the road. And again, it's the size. That's the real issue. I tell you once again, go stand next to a brand new Ford F-150 pickup truck. Why do I pick out that truck? Because it's the most popular vehicle in the United States right now. Number one, Ford F-150. That's it, Ford trucks. They sell a ton of them. The place where I bought my car, or leased my car, is a Ford dealer. They're also a Kia dealer. And they said they just can't keep the trucks on the lot. They just sell before they get them there. They're that popular. Everybody wants a truck. And that is marketing, folks. That is marketing to your insecurity. That's what it is. That's what makes people want to buy things that are more powerful. It's what makes them buy weapons, whether they be wheeled or not. But it's all true. It's all true. And if you look at and talk to anybody who's in the mental health business, they can certainly fill you in on this. It's not uncommon. So the author of this, he said he gets frustrated and impatient too, but safe systems approach is the one he wants to take. If we reduce speed limits in places where a lot of vulnerable road users are, that can have a huge impact. It's true. It can have less impact. In another way of looking at it, infrastructure changes like protected bike lanes, automated enforcement have an impact too. There's plenty we can do in the meantime to save the lives while we wait to figure this thing out. Well, I hope it gets figured out, because I just really think that we are just not going in the right direction. And now, and we want to add into this just to add some more information to stir the more soup into the soup, into the pot here. When we go all electric in this country, those vehicles are going to get heavier. So not only are they going to be big, they're also going to be heavier, like heavier by a fair amount. I think there's close to a 10% increase in the weight of the vehicle when you go to electric because of the batteries. The batteries are heavy. They're heavy. They make the vehicle heavy. Heavier vehicles are harder to stop. Heavier vehicles are harder to control. My bicycle's light. It's really light. Even my heavy bike is light, way lighter than what these things are. So, you know, here we are. I don't know what else to say. So I'm going to move forward, because it's just a little too scary to me to get real, real crazy with. But geez, boy, we could do such a better job at this than we do. And we, you know, we really need to work on that. So what else do I have here on the list? I can go, you know what, I'm going to move on that one, because this is all about New York City and how the DOT, Department of Transportation, by the way, transportation is not just cars and trucks, just a reminder. They are rolling out new tech to better analyze how people move on city streets. Like you'd really need to know, huh? Oh, well, maybe I should go there. Do I have time to go there? Let's see where we're at. Yeah, I got a little bit of time. I can go there. So anyway, what they're doing in the Department of Transportation, they are setting up sensors on 12 locations across the city as part of a pilot program with the tech company Viva to better analyze street designs and programs, learn where safety projects work best, and better understand how people are using public space. The street activity sensor technology allows them to make the streets safer more quickly, Mayor Adams said in a statement. This technology has the potential to save time, money, and lives. We will be monitoring its effectiveness closely and deploying it strategically to understand how we can best maximize its impact. According to the preliminary data collected in March from one sensor at 34th Avenue and 77th Street, the heart of the gold standard open streets, now called Paseo Park, people on foot start flocking to the area as soon as the barricades get up about 7 a.m. The number of pedestrians hits nearly 400 people by 2 p.m. and 300 around just before 6 p.m. Cyclists steadily use the street throughout the day, with nearly 200 riding the blocks at about 5 p.m., according to the data, which was first presented by CureBed, which is an evaluating agency. A visual of who's using the 34th Street open is available online. The sensors will be able to count and identify up to 9 different modes of travel, including pedestrians, bicyclists, e-scooters, analyze traffic patterns, how they change seasonally, measure how fast each mode of transportation is traveling, and detect near crashes. So they're starting to watch us, is what's happening here. Big Brother is watching over you, and they're using cameras, and they wouldn't have to do it if you weren't so stupid, but that's what's going on. The sensors are purposely placed in areas with high concentrations of micro-mobility users. Those are cyclists and pedestrians. And in order to provide crucial real-time analytics needed for street redesigns, you know, you spend an awful lot of money to do something that we've known about for decades. You just got to slow them down. You got to slow down the traffic. And you got to slow down the traffic, and you got to make it smaller. That's it. Or you make the roads smaller so that there's a real serious look at when you go to buy your next vehicle, whether you want to drive that big thing on that small of a space. This isn't rocket science, folks. This is simple common sense. But here we are. Here we are talking about it once again. And we will continue to do this. They got street sensors so they can check and see. That's really wonderful. Man. I don't know what to say. The numbers followed a pattern where a count revealed that there were 323 cars and trucks and 171 bikes, or 1.9 cars and trucks for every bike, despite bikes having just 8 feet of space on a wide road compared to 100 feet for the movement and storage of cars. Well, there you have it right there. So 1.9 cars and trucks per bike. Now, this is New York City, busy place, you know, so obviously it's a great place to do a count like this. So it would be Chicago, LA, Boston, any of those areas where you have a lot of travel and a lot of people in a small space. So, but still 1.9 cars and trucks for every bike that's out there. That's actually a lot of bikes. I see it as a lot of bikes, but you know, they're giving us very, very little space, but they're giving the cars way, 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 way more space. Once we start choking them out, when you start putting in more roundabouts, when you start putting in traffic calming center islands, things that make the vehicle driver have to pay a lot more attention when they're driving down the road and have to really think about how they're going to travel down the road. Once you start doing that, people will change. They'll have to. They will really have to. And things will get safer. There are simple solutions, once again. And traffic lights are hideous. I don't even want to get started on traffic lights. They, I have a traffic light, which is a mile and a half from my house, and they put it in. It has been there for a long time, but they also widened the road a few years ago. So we went from, it's a state road, and it's Route 6, and it's a state road, and it had a travel lane going east-west and a travel lane going west-east. So two lanes, center line, shoulders on the side. Well, that wasn't good enough. They had to make it four lanes going in each direction. And when they did, and they did it right out by this traffic light right here. So that's where the road widens. It's also where the road narrows as you're going out of town. But anyway, it's still four lanes, two on each side, and a sizable shoulder. Good for the sizable shoulder. They don't work. That's a bad idea. It does not make things safer. It just makes it easier to play with your smartphone while you're driving and drift off the road and not crash into anything. That's my evaluation of wide shoulders. And unfortunately, if you are a cyclist and you're in that wide shoulder, then you become a victim of the crime. But another story in itself. So anyway, since they put the wider road in this intersection, there have been not less, more fatalities. I'm not talking just crashes. I'm talking fatalities. Why? Because people are on a road which is posted at 45 or 50 miles an hour, and they're going 70. And when they're going 70 and they come bearing around the corner that comes into this traffic light, they don't have enough time or choose not to have enough time to stop at the traffic light as it's turning red or has turned red, and someone is going through it on a green light going the other way, they get T-boned, and then the rest is dealt with at the local funeral home. Not good. Not good at all. So it's like bigger roads are deadly by design. Let it be known. It's not a good thing. Ah, enough. I can't go any further there. I gotta go move my way over to some bicycle racing. Good old bicycle racing. So, what are we talking about? Last weekend was the Amstel Gold Race, one of the major, it's a trio of legendary races in the hills of Northern Europe. The Amstel Gold Race was a 155-kilometer route, and it takes on 21 short but steep, sharp climbs, including five ascents and the iconic Kauberg. So in the women's race, there was a ruthless attack on the Kauberg, and the Amstel, the highlights were basically Demi Vollering. She made history. The distinctive attack would be ultimately decide the race with less than 2 kilometers to go. Demi Vollering switched on the, they call it here, the SD Work Show, because that's who she rides for, and tuned us all in. Her attacks was so expertly timed and executed that by the time the group had looked over and realized what was happening, she'd already opened up a gap. No one was able to catch her wheel. Demi has been second in this race for the last two editions. As she soloed in the last 800 meters to the line, we saw the joy spread across her face as she realized she had the win. She's now the only rider, in addition to Philippe Gilbert, to win the Strada Bianca and the Amstel Gold in the same season. Latke Kopecky she sprinted to second right behind her and celebrated just as much because that was her teammate that had crossed the line in front of her. So pretty cool stuff. It's fun to watch. You can find YouTube clips out there. It's a lot of fun to watch if you get a chance. Pretty good stuff. In the men, well, what can we say? What can we say? We can say, Tade. Yeah, he did it. Yeah, he's just killing it. I don't know what to say. I can't wait for the big races. I can't wait for the big classic races because Tade Pogacar is on fire right now. And he destroyed the field at Amstel Gold. And Ben Healy was second, and Tom Pidcock secured a third. But it says here, the relentless Slovenian, who slipped into a decisive move with 90 kilometers to go, shrugged off a bike change before launching a trademark long-range solo attack to continue his spectacular spring. After launching multiple attacks, the Slovenian finally broke away with 29 kilometers to go, dropping the last two riders able to shadow with him. And that was Ben Healy and Tom Pidcock. And he just left them. So I couldn't help but go to Strava to check out his results because, you know, I follow him on Strava and it's always got results out there. So I'm looking at this thing. 6 hours and 28 minutes to go 156.61 miles, which averages him out at 26 miles per hour. Okay, just for starters. 11,450 feet of elevation. That's a lot of climbing, folks. His average cadence. This guy just drives me nuts. I don't know how you do it. I can't get my average cadence up much over 70 to 80 RPMs. And I'm a spinner. I spin a lot. And this guy's maximum cadence was 140 RPMs, which I've did that yesterday when I was out riding. I mean, I can do 140 RPMs. I don't think much about it. But his average was 93. Mine was 78, just to give you an idea. That's why, like I said, you want to be a pro? This is what you get to look forward to. Just incredible. The man just turns pedals like a machine. And he's, and we're talking about, like, what did I just say here? We said it was 11,450 feet of climbing. He averaged 93 RPMs. Yeah. That man is a machine. He is a cardiovascular machine. It's just really, really amazing to watch him. I'm fascinated whenever I see him ride. He's not alone. There's a lot of other riders that are turning over those high RPMs. There was this guy years ago that, you know, never really won anything, even though he won everything. We know who he is. He also had a really bad relationship with drugs. So he no longer has any titles that he ever won. But anyway, he could move a bike. He could move a bike and he could spin. Boy, could he spin. He was a cardiovascular machine. I once read that Armstrong's VO2 max was somewhere around 84, which is like just off the charts, crazy high. And probably one of the highest of any athlete in the world, really. And when you've got that kind of ability to process oxygen at the level these guys are processing oxygen, you have an advantage because you're getting more oxygen to the muscles and you're able to spin your legs around faster because you've got that ability. So it makes it so that as you train your cardiovascular system to be able to handle the efforts that you're putting out, your cardiovascular system can get stronger and stronger and stronger. Your legs can only get so strong. And then they're going to say, that's it. We don't have anything left. And they will run out of gas before your cardiovascular system will, if you've trained it correctly. That's the only thing I can imagine. I would love to know what Pagacha's VO2 max is. If anybody has that information, please send it over to me because I am dying to know. That would be kind of a cool thing. I'll Google that when I get done with the show today, see if anybody's got that recorded somewhere, because he obviously can process oxygen better than a lot of other people can, and that's probably why he's able to maintain 93 RPMs. But every single race I have seen him do this year, his average cadence is always at 93. He's like a metronome. He's just down, got it down to a science. Pretty amazing stuff. A lot of fun to watch. So that was the Amstel Gold Race. It was, if you didn't get a chance to see it, there's YouTube clips that you can check out. You can see, you know, some of the highlights on that and see what you think. And, you know, check and see what you think. So, future episodes coming up. I got a piece here about the car and motorcycle business, and the car and motorcycle brands are betting heavily on bike shop quality e-bikes. Keep your eyes open, folks. Remember what I talked about with Musk earlier about the prediction? Yeah, guess what? They're all watching. They're all watching real, real carefully because the bicycle, the e-bicycle, it's really the answer. It's going to change everything we know here. Putting motors on bicycles in a practical way for those of us in the United States who are generally lazy, that was probably a smart move for the future because it just enables more people accessibility to a bicycle and being able to transport themselves in a much more practical way. I am definitely a strong believer in it. I was at first a curmudgeon about it and not really psyched about the fact that we were going to have all these e-bikes out there. It's too much of a purist, but I've changed in a big way. So let's move on to events here because we still have some events coming up here. And remember, coming up, the 106th edition of the 2023 Giro d'Italia starts on May 6th. And so we'll be keeping our eyes on that. I'll be talking about that coming up really soon because it is very, very close by. Also, I'll be getting into a little bit more about May being bike month and the different events that are going on there. In the meantime, the 110th edition of the 2023 Tour de France will begin on July 1st this year. And the Vuelta a España, the last of the big three, will begin in Barcelona on August 26th, 2023. The CCAP Mountain Bike Race Series has begun. Last weekend's was the first one. And so we will have more of those coming up. I believe it's a 4-week series for getting the young riders into mountain bike racing. So that's pretty cool. The International Ride of Silence is on May 17th, 2023. We will be hosting a branch of it here in Storrs, Connecticut. And really, really excited about that. We're getting a lot of feedback on it and getting some more press. Still working on some more of that this week. And yes, Billy, if you're listening, I will get you a press release. Sorry about that. I keep forgetting. don't forget that about the bicycle game in Hartford. If you're looking for some entertainment and knowledge, great place to bring the kids. Teach them all about where bicycles came from right here in Hartford, Connecticut. That's a cool thing. On Saturday, April 22nd, there is the Quiet Corner Bike Tour presented by our local club, the Thread City Cyclers. Come explore the roads of northeastern Connecticut. Let me open your eyes to what riding can be. While you're at it, on August 19th, the Steeplechase Bike Tour opens up yet more northeastern Connecticut roads. So, cool stuff. That's all on my calendar. Finishing points. Don't forget about the bike game at the bicycle game at the Connecticut Historical Society in Hartford. And so, the SUV. What's your opinion on the behemoth car and truck industry? You obviously know mine. Is it why gravel riding is on the upswing? Could be, you never know. And what are you doing about the new gearing on your road bike? Have you made the change? Drop me a note. Let me know. I want to see what's going on out there. I want to see what the trends are. See how people are doing, how people are doing with it. I've made the change. I got to tell you, it is wonderful. I like it a lot. I can spin my legs faster on the hills. I can climb better. Things are not looking so bad for this old guy. So, anyway, I'm going to say it again. It won't be my last time. Get loud. Get active. Our time has come. Stop complaining about traffic, dangerous roads, the price of gas, the lack of places to safely ride your bike, and join the revolution of change. Remember, when you're presenting to your local governments, come with solutions, not complaints or problems. Positive beats negative every time. Please support your local bike shop. Respect one another. It's 2023. Initiate. Participate, ride your bike, tell everyone you know. And finally, take on the Pedal and Run Challenge. If you have a motorized vehicle, park it for a day. Just use your bike. See what happens. You might surprise yourself. Anyway, that is it. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. I am Peddlin' Ron. Remember, keep the rubber side down and the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. It really could save your life. I'll talk about that in the next episode, too. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org. Thank you so much for listening.